Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, June 8th. I'm Dagna, your reader today, and I will be reading local news, Siouxland news, and the tri-state news. And we will begin with the mini editorial on the front page. And today's mini editorial is written by Douglas Vandervoort of Sioux City. And Douglas writes, "One might think that opening and closing the city's pools each year would not require rehashing twice a year, but it is easy to be wrong." Again, this was written by Douglas Vandervoort of Sioux City. And our first story is from the Sioux City Council meeting on Monday evening, and the headline is, "Sioux City Council votes to amend agreements with Warrior Hotel Developer." And this was written by Dolly Butts, a Sioux City Journal reporter. The Sioux City Council approved a resolution Monday to amend development and minimum assessment agreements for the redevelopment of the newly renovated Warrior Hotel and Davidson building. The council voted 4-0 to authorize the execution of a third amendment to the development agreement, a first amendment to the minimum assessment agreement, as well as a substituted promissory note with the Warrior Hotel Limited Partnership. Mayor Pro Tem Dan Moore abstained from voting on the item, citing a conflict of interest. There was no discussion among council members before the vote. According to city documents, the proposed resolution and amendments were requested because the impact of COVID-19 and increased costs of construction have resulted in a financial deficit for the project. In late February, the developer was initially seen to divert $1 million in funds set aside for a skywalk extension, but the council ultimately voted to delete the item from its agenda at the developer's request. Under the terms of the amendments, the minimum assessed value for the development property in the amount of not less than $15 million will be delayed from January 1, 2020 to January 1, 2021, according to the documents. The property tax rebate grant payments will also be delayed 1 year, with the first rebate payment commencing on November 1, 2022. The proposed substituted promissory note in the amount of $2,693,511.90 will require interest-only payments in the total amount of $177,396.90. Beginning on July 1, 2021 through July 1, 2023. On July 1, 2023, interest and principal payments will begin. The term of the note will be extended 2 years until January 1, 2043. The requirements for full-time employees will also be adjusted, with the developer employing 50 full-time employees by July 1, 2021. The developer or its affiliates will employ 72 full-time employees and maintain them through the termination date of the development agreement on December 31, 2041. The Warrior sat vacant for more than 3 decades before Lou Weinberg partnered with Restoration St. Louis to redevelop the 200,000 square feet of combined space in the Warrior and the Davidson building into a 148-room Marriott Autograph Hotel and 22 luxury apartments. The renovation project, which began in February of 2019, started out with an estimated cost of $56 million based on preliminary drawings, but that figure rose to $73 million, largely due to construction cost inflation. The Iowa Economic Development Authority awarded the project more than $11.3 million in historic preservation tax credits, and the council agreed to guarantee $16.5 million for it. The next story I'm going to read is a national story, but it is of local interest for some people. It's concerning a Alzheimer's drug. And the headline is, FDA okays controversial Alzheimer's drug. Government health officials on Monday approved the first new drug for Alzheimer's disease in nearly 20 years, disregarding warnings from independent advisors that the much-debated treatment hasn't been shown to help slow the brain-destroying disease. The Food and Drug Administration approved the drug from Biogen based on study results showing it seemed reasonably likely to benefit Alzheimer's patients. It is the only therapy that U.S. regulators have said can likely treat the underlying disease rather than manage symptoms like anxiety and insomnia. The decision, which could impact millions of Americans and their families, is certain to spark disagreements among physicians, medical researchers, and patient groups. It also has far-reaching implications for the standards used to evaluate experimental therapies, including those that show only incremental benefits. The new drug, which Biogen developed with Japan's Eisai company, did not reverse mental decline, slowing it in only one study. The medication, and it's aducanumab, will be marketed as Aduhelm and is to be given as an infusion every 4 weeks. Dr. Caleb Alexander, an FDA advisor who recommended against the drug's approval, said he was surprised and disappointed by the decision. Alexander said, "The FDA gets the respect that it does because it has regulatory standards that are based on firm evidence. In this case, I think they gave the product a pass." And Dr. Alexander is a medical researcher at Johns Hopkins University. The FDA's top drug regulator acknowledged that residual uncertainty surround the drug, but said Aduhelm's ability to reduce harmful clumps of plaque in the brain is expected to help slow dementia. The data supports patients and caregivers having the choice to use this drug, Dr. Patricia Cavazzoni told reporters. She said the FDA carefully weighed the input of people living with a devastating, debilitating, and deadly disease. Under the terms of the so-called accelerated approval, the FDA is requiring Biogen to conduct a follow-up study to confirm benefits for patients. If the study fails to show effectiveness, the FDA could pull the drug from the market, though the agency rarely does so. Biogen said the drug would cost about $56,000 for a typical year's worth of treatment and said the price would not be raised for 4 years. Most patients won't pay anywhere near that thanks to insurance coverage and other discounts. The company said it aims to complete the FDA-mandated follow-up trial by 2030. Biogen shares jumped 38% in trading Monday on the news, which analysts forecasting billions in future sales. The Cambridge, Massachusetts-based company plans to begin shipping millions of doses within 2 weeks. The nonprofit Institute for Clinical and Economic Review, which studies drug value, said Biogen's drug would have to halt dementia entirely to justify its $56,000 per year price tag. Some 6 million people in the United States and many more worldwide have Alzheimer's, which gradually attacks areas of the brain needed for memory, reasoning, communication, and basic daily tasks. In the final stages of the disease, those afflicted lose the ability to swallow. The global burden of the disease, the most common cause of dementia, is only expected to grow as millions more baby boomers progress further into their 60s and 70s. The drug helps clear a protein called beta amyloid from the brain. Other experimental drugs have done that, but they made no difference in patients' ability to think, care for themselves, or live independently. The pharmaceutical industry drugs pipeline has been littered for years with failed Alzheimer's treatments. The FDA's green light Monday is likely to revive investments in therapies previously shelved by drug makers. Our next story is headlined, "Defense to argue Ottawa teen should not get 50 years for murder." And this story is written by Nick Hytrek of the Sioux City Journal. Lawyers for an Ottawa teen found guilty of murder plan to present evidence that he should not be sentenced to 50 years in prison. District Judge Dwayne Hoffmeyer has rescheduled what was to be Jade Lee Newbaum's sentencing hearing on June 29th as an evidentiary hearing in which his defense would argue that he not received the mandatory prison system. A Monona County District Court jury on May 20th found Newbaum, 18, guilty of second-degree murder for the January 31, 2020, shooting death of 16-year-old Joseph Hopkins in Mapleton, Iowa. In an order filed last week, Hoffmeyer referred to a 2012 U.S. Supreme Court ruling that said juveniles could not be sentenced under adult sentencing guidelines without a judge first conducting a hearing and considering other factors. Newbaum was 17 at the time of the shooting. Iowa law says that if a person was under age 18 at the time of an offense, other than a Class A felony, when the offense was committed, a judge may suspend all or part of the prison sentence, including any mandatory minimum sentence. Second-degree murder is a Class B felony that carries a 50-year prison sentence with a mandatory minimum of 35 years before the offender is eligible for parole. Neubaum has been charged with first-degree murder, which is a Class A felony, but the jury found him guilty of the lesser charge. Prior to trial, Hoffmeier denied public defender Larry Lau's motion to have Neubaum tried in a juvenile court. Hopkins of Mapleton was shot once in the forehead with a 12-gauge shotgun while he, Neubaum, and other teenage boys were working on a demolition derby car in a garage at the home of Neubaum's grandmother, with whom he was living at the time. Prosecutors said Neubaum shot Hopkins after becoming angry with him because he would not stop playing with an unloaded 20-gauge shotgun. The defense said the shooting was an accident. Neubaum still faces prosecution in Monona County for 10 counts of third-degree sexual abuse for the alleged rape of 6 teenage girls and forced sexual contact with a seventh in 2019 and 2020. He has pleaded not guilty to all charges and is scheduled to stand trial in December. Police continue to search for suspect in Saturday shooting. Sioux City Police are continuing their search for a suspect wanted in a shooting that sent one man to the hospital Saturday morning. As of Monday morning, police continue to look for Corey Deontay Smith, 22, of Sioux City. Smith is still considered armed and dangerous. At this time, we are not sure if he is still in the area or fled, and are asking for the public's help in locating him, Sergeant Jeremy McClure said in a news release. Ideally, we would ask for him to contact us and arrange for his peaceful surrender. Smith is 5 foot 11 inches tall, weighs 160 pounds, and has numerous tattoos on his neck, the name Tanya on his left arm, Loyalty on his right arm, and Blessed on his chest. At approximately 10:22 a.m. Saturday, investigators were dispatched to a West 19th Street apartment complex for a report of a shooting. On arrival, officers discovered a male who was suffering from numerous gunshot wounds. The victim was transported to a local hospital where he was treated and released a short time later. The victim, whose name isn't being released at the present time, is said to be cooperating with authorities. Police investigating drowning of 18-year-old, Lakeview, Iowa. Authorities are investigating the Sunday drowning death of an 18-year-old Texas man at Black Hawk Lake in Lakeview. According to a statement from the Lakeview Police Department, the victim is Brian Valencia of Willis, Texas. At 6:17, first responders were dispatched to the beach at Camp Crescent for a possible drowning in Black Hawk Lake. The statement said witnesses told officers that Valencia was swimming in the roped-off beach when he started to struggle to swim. He went underwater and never resurfaced, according to the statement. Lakeview Fire Rescue personnel conducted a search for Valencia and located his body. He was taken to Loring Hospital in Sac City, where he was pronounced dead. The drowning remains under investigation, according to the statement. Human Rights Commission planning event. The Sioux City Human Rights Commission will host an event June 15th that will highlight de-escalation techniques to stressful situations. Strengthening and improving community relationships will begin at 7 p.m. at the Sioux City Public Museum at 607 4th Street. Participants will include Sioux City Police Chief Rex Mueller, Woodbury County Sheriff Chad Sheehan, Sioux City Human Rights Commission Executive Director Karen Mackey, Human Rights Commission staff member Flora Lee, and Trudy Sewell, a licensed mental health counselor. Sponsors include the Sioux City Human Rights Commission, Sioux City Police Department, and Woodbury County Sheriff's Office. The event is free and open to the public. Road work to close section of Highway 10, Sioux Center. The Iowa Department of Transportation will close a section of Iowa Highway 10 in Sioux County later this week for a bridge approach and pavement rehabilitation project. Highway 10 west of U.S. Highway 75 will be closed on Thursday, weather permitting, for 6 weeks. During the construction, traffic will be detoured onto Sioux County Roads B46 and K22. Portion of Donner Avenue to close for rail crossing repairs. Sioux City. Donner Avenue between South York Street and Lewis Boulevard will close next week for railroad crossing repairs. The Sioux City Engineering Division said in a statement that the closure will begin the morning of June 14th and will reopen the afternoon of June 18th after Union Pacific has repaired a damaged crossing surface. Motorists are asked to reduce speed, drive cautiously, and obey all traffic control signs during the closure. Work to begin on I-129 bridge over Dakota Avenue, South Sioux City. Work is expected to begin this week on surface joint repairs to the eastbound Interstate 129 bridge over Dakota Avenue in South Sioux City. Traffic on the bridge has been reduced to one lane, and speeds will be reduced to 45 miles per hour in the work zone. The loop carrying southbound Dakota Avenue traffic onto eastbound I-129 will be closed. Motorists southbound on Dakota Avenue will be detoured onto westbound I-129 to the U.S. Highway 75 interchange, where they will exit onto southbound U.S. 75 and then take the loop onto eastbound I-129. The project is expected to be completed in early fall, according to the Nebraska Department of Transportation. Lincoln Elementary to become Performing Arts Center, Sioux City. 5 years after being vacated, the old Lincoln Elementary School building will soon be getting a facelift, a new life, and a new purpose. Flux Dance Company said Monday it has acquired the building and is currently undergoing renovations to create a performing arts center. And that Flux Dance Company, the name is spelled F-L-U-X. We envision this beautiful piece of Sioux City's history to be the home of a variety of music, dance, theatrical, and other creative activities pertaining to the arts, Flux Dance Company's artistic director Jessica McCulley said. Our mission is to strengthen the cultural landscape of Siouxland. The two-story brick building at 115 Midvale Avenue was built in 1953 and contains over 27,000 square feet. It was closed in 2016 when Perry Creek Elementary was opened. The building will provide instruction, rehearsal, and performing space to the performing arts community. McCulley said the board is reaching out to individuals in the performing arts community to determine various desired accommodations. The first phase of the project is scheduled to be completed this year. The first floor will be remodeled to suit dance studios and music rooms. There are suites with private entrances available for rent. The entire upper floor will eventually be available to other interested parties with purposes pertaining to the performance arts. An outdoor performance area is planned to accommodate music, theater, and dance concerts outside. After the first phase of renovations is completed, the building will be open for the public to view. Artistic performances as well as a carnival for families are planned as part of the grand opening week. Details on the opening will be released as soon as they are available. Now I'll do a quick recap of the weather, upcoming weather. And today, Tuesday, is scheduled to be warm. By the time you hear this, you'll know that it probably did hit the predicted high of 92. Wednesday's predicted high is 94 with a low of 71. Thursday is predicted to be even warmer at 96 degrees with a low of 70. And then on Friday, it's not quite as hot and a possible thunderstorm in the morning. The predicted high is 87 with a low of 59. And Saturday, it, again, will be plenty of sunshine with a predicted high of 89 and a low of 61. I'm now moving to the opinion page, and there is no letters to the editor today. But there is an editorial from St. Louis, from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and I'll read that for you. This is headlined, Out of Office, Trump is Still Bilking Taxpayers. Former President Donald Trump, who spent 4 years milking U.S. taxpayers as if they were hapless marks for one of his scammy business ventures, is still at it. The Washington Post reports that Trump this year has charged the Secret Service more than $40,000 to work from his Florida club while providing his post-presidential security. Trump should not be required to provide free space to a Secret Service detail, but Congress should look into requiring that former presidents cannot charge more than the normal governmental rates to their protectors. Trump began his presidency with a sham vow that he would stay out of directly running his businesses while in office. Then he put his adult children in charge, meaning he kept control. Then, for 4 years, he blatantly and repeatedly violated the Constitution's prohibition on profiteering from the presidency. Government officials, including Trump's Vice President Mike Pence, somehow ended up staying repeatedly at Trump's properties when they traveled. The U.S. Air Force put up pilots at Trump's Scotland resort, which was neither the most convenient for them nor the best deal for the taxpayers. Lobbyists and foreign dignitaries racked up the room rates nights at Trump's Washington Hotel, probably believing that spending money there could get them in good with the president, a belief he did nothing to contradict. Trump even tried to get a G7 Global Economic Summit held at the Trump National Doral Miami Golf Resort, backing down only after the rare pushback from Congress. Despite that defeat, Trump's company still managed to bill the U.S. government for at least $2.5 million during his time in office. Trump's exit from office hasn't ended his fleecing of the taxpayers. Providing security for life to ex-presidents is a sad necessity in today's world, but squeezing that arrangement for an ex-president's personal enrichment isn't. The Washington Post review of expense records from the time Trump left office on January 20th until the end of April found the Secret Service had paid Mar-a-Lago a total of $40,011.15 during that time alone for room rentals of $396 and 15 cents nightly the entire time. That was for one room that Secret Service agents used as workspace while Trump stayed at the property. Trump is, by his own assertions, a multi-billionaire whose taxpayer-funded spending as president on his constant travel to his own properties already was likely unprecedented, and who is now entitled to taxpayer-funded protection for life. Given all that, it wouldn't seem a terrible sacrifice to set aside a workspace at the sprawling resort at no or reduced cost to the taxpayers. Congress cannot force such reasonableness on this historically unreasonable and selfish president, but it could require that the standard rates that government is normally allowed to pay for hotels and travel would apply to post-presidential security as well. It's time, at last, for the taxpayers to close this blank checkbook. Again, this was an opinion piece written from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Our next story is from Nebraska, and it says Nebraska County could pay off judgment in next 3 years. A Nebraska county that was ordered to pay $28.1 million to six people wrongfully convicted of murder may be able to cover the balance of the federal judgment in the next 3 years, much sooner than first expected, officials said. Gage County officials had initially predicted that it would take 9 years to pay off the legal judgment, according to the Beatrice Daily Sun. The change in schedule came after state lawmakers and Governor Pete Ricketts approved $4 million in state money this year to help the county. Senators also passed a state law in 2019 to let the county impose a half-cent sales tax to pay off the judgment faster, despite objections from Ricketts that it bypass the normal process of seeking voter approval. The sales tax has generated about $1 million a year and will expire once the judgment is fully paid. The Gage County also settled with its insurance carriers to receive nearly $6 million towards the judgment. Gage County made its first payment, totaling $1.9 million in June 2019 after exhausting all of its appeals. As of December, the county has paid $14.9 million to the wrongfully convicted people, collectively known as the Beatrice Six. In a meeting Wednesday, the Gage County Board of Supervisors formally thanked Ricketts, State Senator Myron Dorn, who represents the area, and other lawmakers who approved the financial assistance. "The light is at the end of the tunnel," said County Board Chairman Eric Thiemann. "We're at that four-year range and 3 years potentially with this. We're going to keep clicking away, and this will be behind us before we know it." The Beatrice Six were convicted in the 1985 rape and murder of 68-year-old Helen Wilson in her downtown Beatrice apartment. They were arrested in March and April 1989 and spent a combined 75 years in prison until DNA evidence showed another man had committed the crime. In 2016, a federal jury awarded the six a combined $28.1 million. Similar legislative bills failed to gain traction in the past, but Dorn, who was the chairman of the Gage County Board of Supervisors before being elected to the legislature, previously said it helped with the county settled with the insurance carriers last year. In August, Gage County reached a settlement with insurance companies, including Nebraska Intergovernmental Risk Management Association, Employers Mutual Casualty, and four excess insurance carriers for the settlement. Iowa prisons to resume visitation for inmates who are vaccinated. The Iowa Department of Corrections has announced it will resume in-person visitation in early July for those prisoners who have been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. The department announced the decision Friday, as more than 58% of those incarcerated in Iowa's prisons were reported fully vaccinated, and 62% reported as having had at least one shot. Iowa's prisons and jails banned visitors in early March 2020 as the outbreak of the coronavirus hit the U.S. Inmates were instead allowed free video visits, an option that will continue after the visitor ban is lifted. The decision in Iowa was made after prison officials spoke to state health officials and looked at what other state prison systems were doing as more people became vaccinated, department spokesman Cord Overton said. Once the word is spread around about the visitation restriction, I would expect to see more inmates get vaccinated, Overton said. Visitors do not have to be vaccinated, Overton said. Prison officials based that on the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidance for visitation at long-term care facilities that say patients should be fully vaccinated but does not say visitors must be vaccinated. Since the pandemic began, more than 4,800 Iowa prisoners have been infected and 19 have died from COVID-19. More than 700 Iowa prison staff also contracted the virus and two staffers died. Capitol riot suspect blames pack of lies, seeks release. Des Moines. A Des Moines man pictured prominently with a QAnon shirt ahead of a crowd of insurgents inside the U.S. Capitol during the January 6 attack asked a judge on Monday to release him from jail, saying he feels deceived, recognizing that he bought into a pack of lies. Douglas Jensen, in a document filed by his attorney, said he believed he was a true patriot for going to Washington at the urging of President Donald Trump. He says his intention was to only observe. Jensen claims he is a victim of numerous conspiracy theories that were being fed to him over the internet by a number of very clever people who were uniquely equipped with slight, if any, moral or social consciousness. Jensen's attorney, Christopher Davis, said in the document that Jensen was not part of any mob and simply went to Washington to watch. Davis acknowledged Jensen was in front of a crowd, but argued he did that for the now-disclosed silly reason to show his QAnon shirt to get it recognized. Davis said Jensen neither threatened physical harm to anyone nor destroyed property. Jensen had his work pocket knife on him for protection when he went to the Trump rally preceding the march to the Capitol, Davis said in the court filing. Video and photographs of Jensen have been widely distributed, showing him wearing a QAnon shirt as he pursued Capitol Police Officer Eugene Goodman as a mob follows them up the stairs inside the Capitol. Davis said Jensen has been in custody since he turned himself in on January 9th. Languishing in a D.C. jail cell, locked down most of the time, he feels deceived, recognizing that he bought into a pack of lies. Jensen is scheduled to appear at an arraignment Tuesday before a federal judge in Washington. In February, federal prosecutors upgraded the charges filed against him to include entering a restricted building with a dangerous weapon and disorderly or disruptive conduct in a restricted building with a dangerous weapon. Other counts include civil disorder, obstruction of an official proceeding, assaulting or impeding officers, disorderly conduct in a Capitol building, and parading, demonstrating, or picketing a Capitol building. Task Force seeks man from Siouxland. The U.S. Marshal Service Northern Iowa Fugitive Task Force is seeking the public's assistance in locating the following person. Rafael Gomez, 19. He is 5'6" tall and weighs 145 pounds. Gomez is wanted by the U.S. Marshal Service on a federal warrant for violation of federal firearm laws. If you have information about this person, call the Northern Iowa Fugitive Task Force at 712-252-0211. You can also go online at suelands.most-wanted@usdoj.gov. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, June 8th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now turn to today's obituaries. And we have two notices today, service notices. The first one is from Remsen. Timothy R. Kelly, 66, died Saturday, June 5th. Services will be June 9th at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Remsen. Burial will be at a later date at the St. Mary Cemetery in Remsen. Visitation is today, June 8th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Fish Funeral Home and Monument in Remsen, and will resume 1 hour prior to service time at the funeral home. Merle Wilkin, from Lamar's, 80, died Saturday, June 5th. Services are tomorrow, June 9th, at 10 a.m. at St. John's Lutheran Church in Craig, Iowa. Burial will be at the St. John's Lutheran Cemetery in Craig. Visitation is today, June 8th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamar's, and will resume from 9 a.m. until service time at the church. And that is all we had for funeral notifications and obituaries. Our next story headline is Iowa approves millions in Regent-related settlements. The state of Iowa agreed Monday to pay $5.7 million to offer compensation for or settle 8 separate accusations of discrimination and negligence at its public universities, including payments to former University of Iowa police officers who sued for age discrimination, a sound tech hurt at a University of Northern Iowa concert, and a UI student who crashed her moped after slipping on campus fuel. As the settlements include several allegations of medical negligence at the UI hospitals and clinics, the UI Physicians Group is paying $2.7 million of the total, with the state general fund covering the remaining $3 million. So far this budget year, which ends in just a few weeks on June 30th, the state has paid from its general fund $4.67 million to settle lawsuits or comply with judgments against state entities. Of that, $4.1 million, or 88%, is related to Board of Regents institutions. UNI Dome Forklift. Among the biggest checks approved on Monday, for $1.8 million, went to a Massachusetts man who on February 21, 2016, was working as a sound technician for a Luke Bryan concert at the UNI Dome in Cedar Falls. Francisco Sambaloni, in a lawsuit filed September 18, 2018, accused University of Northern Iowa Assistant Director of Facilities and Operations Trenton Ames of hitting him with a forklift he was operating in reverse while tearing down after the concert, striking Zamboloni's leg and ankle. Zamboloni was loading sound and staging equipment into a truck at the time he was hit by the forklift that was owned by the state, according to his lawsuit. He accused Ames of failing to maintain a proper lookout, maintain control of the forklift, and act as a reasonable driver. He accused the state of failing to properly train and supervise Ames, and for entrusting the equipment to him in the first place. A jury in April ruled in Zamboloni's favor, awarding him $302,791 for past damages, $1.5 million for future damages, and $2,468 for recoverable costs. UI Police Age Discrimination. The state settled for a total of $150,000 with three former UI police officers who in December 2018 sued the institution and its administrators for creating and enabling a culture of discrimination, including age and disability discrimination. Former UI Associate Director of Public Safety William Searles, who was 57 at the time, former Captain Ian Scott, 54 at the time, and former Captain Lauren Noska, 51 at the time, accused then Public Safety Director Scott Beckner, Associate Director David Vizen, and Senior Vice President of Finance and Operations Rod Leonards of the discrimination. In their lawsuits, the former employees reported Beckner in April 2017, told them their positions were being eliminated as part of a reorganization amid budget concerns, even as younger employees saw their pay increased. All three in their lawsuits accused Bechner of treating younger, white male employees more favorably than employees protected by the Iowa Civil Rights Act, including special treatment in assignments, duties, promotions, and disciplinary action, such as refusing to order internal affairs investigations on younger male employees who were reported to have violated department or university policies as well as state law. In a statement to the Gazette in 2018, UI spokeswoman Janine Beck said Bechner reorganized the department after careful review of the department's governance structure, budget, and priorities moving forward. Bechner, after 4 years on the job, retired at the end of 2020. He had intended to leave in June, but extended his stay through the end of the fall 2020 semester due to COVID-19. As part of the state's new settlements with Searles, Scott, and Nazca, they've agreed to drop from their claims defendants Vizen and Leonards, maintaining the allegations against UI and Bechner. The state on May 24th had agreed to settle with each of the former officers for different amounts. Nazca and his attorneys will receive $75,000, Searles and his lawyers will get $50,000, and Scott and his counsel will receive $25,000. Moped crash. Another UI-related settlement pays UI student Hannah Moore $25,000 after she lost control and crashed her moped in May 2018 by slipping on diesel fuel that had spilled out of UI Biana campus. According to Moore's April 2020 lawsuit, the fuel cap was left off the campus when it finished fueling on the evening of May 5, 2018, spilling diesel along the roadway. When Moore drove over the spilled fuel, she lost traction. She suffered injuries to her neck, shoulder, and hand, along with road rash, and $900 in damage to her moped. UIHC negligence. Among the recent UIHC settlements, one, totaling $3.5 million, went to an Iowa City mother and father who accused physicians of negligence during the birth of their daughter. That state has agreed to pay $875,000 of the total, with the UI Physicians Group covering $2.63 million. Shanta Burr and Ebony Burton Payne sued the state and UIHC in March 2019 after their baby suffered seizure activity shortly after birth and was diagnosed with a lack of oxygen. In their lawsuit, the couple reports that after being admitted for labor induction at 38 weeks pregnancy, a doctor educated them on the risks of induction and asked the mother to sign a consent for possible cesarean section. Ebony was not offered the option of a non-labor primary cesarean delivery, according to the lawsuit. After days of labor and numerous complexities and challenges, the baby was born on just before 7:30 p.m. September 2nd, according to the lawsuit. With the baby suffering fetal distress and low oxygen, a neonatal resuscitation team was called to the delivery room. In the days that followed, the baby suffered increased seizure activity, and she was discharged from the neonatal intensive care unit October 5th with permanent brain damage. According to the state settlement, the $3.5 million deal is reasonable under the circumstances as the baby continues to have seizures. She is unable to speak, sit, feed herself, or walk. She will require lifelong care, the settlement said. Now we move to South Dakota. South Dakota lawmakers reject school rules for medical pot. South Dakota lawmakers on Monday rejected rules proposed by Governor Kristi Noem's administration that would have set parameters for students who need to use medical marijuana at school. A legislative committee sent the rules back to the Department of Education for revision after complaining that they would have required access to medical pot in private schools and did not spell out what activities would be off-limit to students who use medical marijuana. While voters passed a law that requires state agencies to roll out a medical pot program this year, progress has been slow going. Noem had proposed delaying the implementation of the law, arguing that her administration needed more time to study the issue and create a program, but that effort failed in the Senate. The Republican governor is now tasked with overseeing the program rollout, even though she opposed it when it was on the ballot in November. The Department of Education must come up with policies that allow students with a medical marijuana ID card to use the drug while at school, It has until the beginning of the school year to finalize the rules, though the state will not begin issuing ID cards until November. Secretary of Education Tiffany Sanderson had proposed rules to allow schools and school nurses to opt out of administering medical marijuana, but that would have allowed caregivers to enter schools to do so. Medical marijuana advocates said the arrangements would have placed an unnecessary burden on the parents and caregivers of students who need medical marijuana for conditions such as epilepsy. Lawyers from the Department of Health said their approach would give flexibility to schools to develop a plan with students who use medical marijuana. But lawmakers looking to further limit medical pot use by students sent the proposal back to the Department of Education. Republican Representative Kevin Jensen said he would like to see the rules detail whether students using medical marijuana are allowed to participate in athletics or classes that use machinery. Representative John Hansen, another Republican, argued that the law would not require private schools to allow students to use medical marijuana on the premises. "We're shooting at a moving target here," Jensen said. "There are a lot of agencies that are really involved with a lot of change here, but I'm really uncomfortable moving forward with certain rules when all of those pieces aren't in place yet." Some health experts say medical cannabis, which when given in the correct dosage, can be used by children without producing a high, though researchers are still studying the issues. The American Academy of Pediatrics opposes using medical marijuana, but has also said it recognizes it may be an option for cannabinoid administration for children with life-limiting or severely debilitating conditions and for whom current therapies are inadequate. The Department of Education will next rework the state rules and try to get final approval from the legislative committee tasked with signing off on state agency rule changes. We'll now move to the sports section, and our first story headline is Musketeer Schmid named USHL Goaltender of the Year. For Akira Schmid, life just keeps getting better. He spent much of the season acting like a brick wall in front of the net for the Sioux City Musketeers, and just weeks after signing his entry-level professional contract with the NHL's New Jersey Devils, the Musketeers goaltender received another piece of good news. On Monday, the Musketeers announced that Schmid has been named the USHL Goaltender of the Year. Schmid, a native of Switzerland, appeared in 36 games for Sioux City this past season and put up a 92.1 save percentage and a 2.01 goals against average, both best in the league. After coming over to the United States in 2018, Schmid played for parts of two seasons with the Omaha Lancers and also played for Team Switzerland in the 2020 World Junior Championships. Schmid was traded from Omaha to Sioux City in January of 2020 in the midst of an injury-plagued season, but he thrived in the starting role the next year after undergoing off-season hip surgery. "You've got to be excited for Akira," Musketeers head coach Luke Strand said. "He battled back from the injury that he had the year before and the off-season surgeries to really come full circle and find his way. His ability to overcome and his ability to dig in internally and make sure he is ready is really a sign of a goalie that has a chance to have a long career." Schmid was a fifth-round pick by the Devils in the 2018 NHL Draft, a 136th overall, and signed a three-year contract with the team on May 17th, a week after the Musketeers were eliminated from the Clark Cup playoffs. Strand has no doubt that Schmid is ready for the professional level. "For me, Akira is ready," Strand said. "He is going to continue to grow his consistency, and I think professional hockey sometimes for a goaltender is easier, and the defenses are pretty darn good. The way he plays keeps the puck stuck to him, and he doesn't give up a lot of rebounds. He competes in a really calm manner, and that is the mark of a pro." He was named the USHL Goaltender of the Week four times this past season, the final one coming in mid-April after Schmid put up a 30-save performance against Des Moines, followed by a 22 saves in the next game against Omaha. Following his third Goaltender of the Week award, Schmid made it clear that it wasn't awards that were driving him. "That's all in the past now, so I can't really focus on that too much," Schmid said in an April interview with the Journal. Obviously, it's nice to get recognized sometimes, but you still have to put the work in. It's not getting any easier, so I've got to work hard every day. The Musketeers finished this past season with a 31-21-1 overall record, good for third place in the USHL Western Conference. Sioux City's season came to an end in the Clark Cup Western Conference Finals as Fargo swept the Musketeers. And now we'll have a story on the Explorers. And the headline is, Explorers hit five homers, sweep Salt Dogs. On a windy Sunday afternoon, the Sioux City Explorers picked up their second three-game sweep of the season after a long battle against the Lincoln Salt Dogs with a 10-8 victory. Justin Altman and Ryan Long started the Salt Dogs scoring with a single to center field and a sacrifice fly to score a pair. In the bottom half of the first, Joseph Mung hit a RBI single to center to cut the excess deficit in half, 2-1. In the second inning, Nate Sampson and Chase Harris both hit solo home runs to give the excess a 3-2 lead. Sampson entered the contest having never hit a home run against the Salt Dogs in his career through 53 games. In the bottom of the third, Sebastian Zawanda smashed a two-run homer to center field, his third of the season, giving Sioux City a 5-2 lead. Josh Sermo, continuing his hot hitting weekend, hit a solo bomb over the right field fence for his fourth homer of the series. In the sweep, Sermo was 7-12, with four homers, eight RBI, and seven runs scored. After hitting his first career home run against the Salt Dogs in the second inning, Sampson did it again with another laser to left to make it a 7-2 ball game in the fifth. Sioux City hit five homers, all of them coming off of Salt Dogs starter John Ritchie, who was handed in the loss after he gave up seven runs in five innings. Ritchie allowed 12 hits and three walks while striking out five. Patrick Ledet walked away with the win for the X's as he tossed five innings of two-run ball, surrendering seven hits and two walks while striking out four. The game turned in the seventh inning as the Salt Dogs loaded the bases with nobody out. Sioux City turned to lefty Jose Velez, who got them out of the jam by striking out two and getting all day to the ground out to second to end the threat. In the bottom of the seventh, Sioux City succeeded where Lincoln could not in the top half. The X's had the bases loaded with one out and proceeded to score three runs on a hit batter and two walks. The X's had just one hit, a Sampson double, in the inning. Sampson ended the day going 4-for-5 with two homers and a double, driving in two and scoring three times. Lincoln made the game interesting in the ninth as back-to-back walks to open the inning caused the X's to turn to closer Matt Poborecki. Kurt Smith lined a two-out double down the left field to make it 10-8. When Poborecki got out of the ninth with no further damage, earning his sixth save of the year. The X's will start a new series on Monday against the Chicago Dogs. The X's will send righty Xavier Altamirano to the bump and will be up against right-hander Garrett Christman for the Dogs. First pitch is set for 7:05 p.m. And now we have some local high school briefs. The first one is golf. Round one is in the books at the South Dakota State High School Girls State Golf Meet, and after 18 holes, one Siouxland area school came in with a top five finish in the Class A standings. The Vermilion Girls Golf Team finished the day in fifth place in the team standings with an overall score of 404, with three strokes back of fourth place Madison. Sioux Falls Christian is leading the pack with a score of 352, while Sisseton is second at 375. Winner is currently in third place with a team score of 393. Further down the list, Elk Point Jefferson shot a 440, good for 11th place out of 13 schools. In the individual standings, Maya Muller of Beresford and Kelsey Heath of Sisseton are currently tied for first place with scores of 75, while Sydney Timms of Sioux Falls Christian is third with 79. Kenzie Mulhern of Vermilion shot a round one 94 to tie for 18th place, while teammate Megan Brady tied for 31st at 100 on the day. Sophia Johnson of Elk Point Jefferson shot a 103 to tie for 38th place, while Madison Brunger scored 110 to settle into a three-way tie for 51st. Over in the Class AA tournament, O'Gorman is number one in the team standings with a team score of 309, while Mitchell is second at 330. Three strokes back is third place Aberdeen Central at 333, while Sioux Falls Lincoln is fourth with a score of 341. Rounding out the top five is Harrisburg with a team score of 344. Rhys Jansson of Harrisburg is first in the individual standings with a score of 66, while Shannon McCormick is second at 72. The final day of the Class A state meet will be played on Tuesday in Spearfish. And then softball. Westwood 18, OABCIG 8. The Westwood softball team earned a dominant victory on Monday over AABCIG as the Rebels took down the Falcons in six innings by a score of 18-8. The Rebels took an early lead by scoring four runs in the first inning, two in the second, but OABCIG scored one run in the second inning and five in the third to tie it up at 6-6. But Westwood played it four more in the third inning to take the lead for good. After scoring one more in the fourth, the Rebels pushed across seven runs in the fifth to end the game on the mercy rule. For OABCIG, Haley Harms finished 2-for-4 with two runs scored, while Carter Hemmer had two runs scored as well. For Westwood, Holly Holtz was the winning pitcher, while teammate Jaden Ferris went 4-for-5 with three RBIs and three runs scored. Junior Emma Shook also went 4-for-5 at the plate. With the win, Westwood improved to 5-5 on the season and 2-4 in conference play. With the loss, OABCIG fell to 0-7 on the season with a 0-5 record in Western Valley play. Hinton 4, MMCRU 0. The Hinton softball team scored its fourth consecutive victory on Monday night with a 4-0 win over MMCRU. Junior Jaden Case got the victory by giving up four hits and two walks with eight strikeouts. Case also went for 1-for-2 at the plate with a double and two runs scored, while teammate Madison Guzman was 2-for-3 with an RBI and a run scored. Tonight we came out and competed defensively, leading to a win, head coach Jennifer Jacobs List said. When they started rallies, we were able to get defensive outs so they couldn't score. Offensively, we are moving in the right direction but still have work to do. Overall, it's a good start to the week, but we have to keep improving. With the win, Hinton improved to 7-4 on the season, while MMCRU fell to 2-4. And our final story today is about the Sioux City Arts Center, and headline, Sioux City Arts Center exhibit highlights current events and issues. Curator Mary Ann Redding hopes that those who view Sioux City Arts Center selects not only respond to the aesthetics of the artworks featured, but also the ideas that the pieces convey. What we wanted to do with this installation was really showcase artists that we're looking at through the visual arts, contemporary issues that everyone is grappling with right now, Redding said as she stood in the gallery where Sioux City artist Anne Marie McTaggart's larger-than-life bird paintings hung on a wall near where two of Omaha artist Bart Vargas's globes, which he made from recycled computer keyboard keys, were suspended from the ceiling. The nine artists chosen by Art Center Director Todd Behrens and Redding for the third installation in grant-funded series address a variety of current events through their work, such as climate change, species extinction, gun culture, surveillance, and the global COVID-19 pandemic. Redding said the gallery is a safe place in which to discuss potentially contentious issues. This sort of amorphous figure represents the artist, but it represents each of us as we struggle through the issues that we're faced with, Redding said of Dubuque artist Nate Ditzler's Everyman. Ditzler's blobs of clay relax in an inner tube, push an overloaded grocery cart, sleep on a pillow, and row against the current in a bright red rowboat. We sort of feel like we're pushed around by forces outside of our control. How do we respond to shortages of toilet paper and cleaning supplies? Redding asked. Kansas City artist Laura Nugent found herself panic buying at the paint store during the pandemic, according to Redding. During isolation, Redding said Nugent couldn't get new paper or wood panels, so she began using scraps in her studio. That was sort of her compulsion to make art with everything that was at hand and to find joy in doing that instead of seeing that as a limitation, Redding said of Nugent's artwork. Council Bluffs artist and K-12 teacher Jody Boyer wanted to engage her own children as well as her students in her creative process during the pandemic. She began bringing flowers home. As those flowers began to decay, Redding said she thought about how else she might use them. So she began freezing the flowers in container molds. Then she would bring them out and let them melt. She photographed them in the kitchen, working with her kids to set up everything. She also working with her kids to go out and find flowers, find things in the neighborhood. 9 of Bauer's images of the frozen flowers melting are displayed in the square on the gallery's wall. We like to freeze time. We think we're frozen in time this year, particularly. But what happens when all of that melts? There's also a clear reference to both the ice caps on both poles and what happens when they melt and the sea levels start to rise and we start to lose our coastlines. Again, a lot of issues sort of coming together in the final artwork, Redding said. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, June 8th. I'm your reader, Dagna, and you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you so much for listening.